much, Bernadette. Appreciate that. And thanks so much for the invitation to read. I'm delighted to be here, actually. Delighted for the opportunity to come down. I've heard about the five-word challenge for a long time, but I've never seen it in operation, and I wouldn't even attempt it. So fair dues to and I thought some pretty good outcomes from it as well. So I'm going to read some poems from my collection, and then some more recent poems. Should mention Paul in particular, actually, just to say thanks to him for the invitation before I start. So I'm going to start with a short poem from the collection, and I have a bit of context for younger people here. This I wrote in an airport many years ago, and this was in the days when you had to engage with a human being to check in. And in Dublin Airport, I was given the wrong name on my boarding pass, something I didn't notice until I was in the duty-free and then was heard my name called out on the tannoy. So literally, they'd given me somebody else's boarding pass. And strange thing was, it happened again on the return leg of that journey up in the north of Finland. So I sat down, actually, in the airport in Oulu and wrote this. It's called Boarding Pass. They've given me another person's boarding pass again. Do they detect I'm keen to see the world from someone else's skin? To know how things seem if you're the Mr. Mulqueen, who by now must be passing himself off as me. They'll catch up with us both in the end if we splash out in the duty-free or forget ourselves at the departure gate. So if it cannot be, then change me back to me. Only this time, if you can, make me more like myself than I am. I think it was Nicola earlier had a poem which seemed to maybe refer to current political events. And I find myself for the past year really just gobsmacked, horrified, fascinated by events in the world, and terrified too in many ways, and not knowing, feeling powerless, I suppose, like everybody does, but having some relief in being able to write a poem about it in a very small way. So here's my poem anyway. It's based actually on Siegfried Sassoon's Base Details, which I think most people did if they did the inter-cert or the junior cert or whatever it's called nowadays. So my poem is called Base Campaign Details, and it's just a little oddity, see what you think about it. Base Campaign Details after Siegfried Sassoon. If I were rich and brash and prone to frown, I'd plan a wheeze for whipping up the base. Slackers and strangers it is who drag us down, I'd huff as I tranced those loser candidates. Self-made, drat that inheritance, I'd rail against lame reason's pet civility. You'd hear instead my lynch mob terms entail blows to the face for those that don't agree. And when I'd thrashed that codes protect the weak, you'd watch me claim the first so I could tweet. I'm going to go back to the collection now and read some poems, childhood poems really. I grew up in North Tipperary, as Bernadette said, it was a small village in North Tipperary, and I grew up in a house that had a butcher shop in it because my father ran a butcher shop, and so that's in a way the starting point for this poem, which is called Mince Customer. Pinned to the door was a diagram of a heifer with sections straight lined across her side, sirloin jigsawed between rib and rump, shank slotting into round. And the people who came in, we sorted them by the cuts they bought. Mince customers wanted cosseting, all the work done for them. A fillet woman wanted only lean, leaving all the fat and grizzle on our hands. But a brisket man was a prince who'd take his lean where he could get it between the bone and thews. Inside, too, a series of lines ran through the house like skewers. As a child, you couldn't see them, but bit by bit, you'd puzzle out the no-nonsense pattern they laid down, plot yourself a course in which your silver side was out, with your flank protected, your tenderloins concealed, or else you'd feel the chill from the refrigeration unit as sure as any mince customer. I'm going to stay with childhood for a moment. When I was clearing out my attic some years ago, I found a kaleidoscope which my big brother had given me. And so that's the poem, the kaleidoscope my big brother gave me. It created geometric processions out of rooms, made a pair of butterflies rise from a fireside chair, caused a ball of wool to fan and become a guelder rose, a cylinder of gas to spoke into a four-pronged star, eight eyes to glisten from a hot plate ringed with chrome. It put my reflection in as part of the pattern, let me see myself in a pendulum triangulated by a door mahogany surround. He helped me through a gap that year. Finger to his lips, he slowed the whole summer down, tuned out tractor drone, dog splash, sheep bleat, moved in on one grasshopper sound till we'd dipped level with the angled systems of the insect's exterior, its armoured legs jigging out an oscillating click that swelled in the field, a chant rising in its cathedral. I became a juggler of surfaces, an evangelist of detail, my world broken down, reconfigured. I'd take rubbings from the paint tears hardened down our door, wait outside round the narrowing waterline as polygons broke out across the mud, baked by the sun. I'm going to stay with childhood, but it's a completely up-to-date, very recent poem, probably my most recent poem. And again, it's back to the house that I grew up in, and in one of the rooms in our, which was our living room really, there was a big spot on the wall that was often a blotch of dampness, which we always talked about. It's the weeping stone, and apparently there is such a thing, it's porous stone. There's a reason it sometimes gives out water, but I mean, as a child, I suppose all you knew was that this patch of damp came and went in the front room. And I always thought, God, there has to be a poem in that. There has to be a metaphor in that. And I was years trying to come up with a poem, but this is the poem, Weeping Stone. I had to move slightly. Weeping Stone. And sorry, I should say it's a slightly long poem, just warning you, it's kind of in three sections, so great, gird your loins. If other households had May shrines, we had year-round our hot press. A stepping up would start its routine play of stowing sheets of widths and ends passed up and down, bosom facing bosom. Then white on blue, we'd layer them, off-white on pale pink, in a teetering arc that framed the cylinder. It, strange hub of winter days, had its mysteries too, sealed in the coppery dark, something that hummed and ticked, or drifted down unseen to calcify around the pipework at its heart. If shrines were meant to guard a home against its fears, in our house that was damp. And worst were breakings out we could not stem, within a wall a stone that would weep and drench our surface block decor. Its random bouts perplexed us, so we treated them as signs and said, it means the weather must be set to change. No doubt, if relatives were due, the house spruced and repaired, that blotch was bound to let us down and make absurd the hope that our stigmatic room would turn mundane. If questions brought to shrines outnumbered answers heard, we too were in the dark. Why, we waited to be told, when scorching summers drove us inside from the yard, was there still so much to weep for? For clocks too old to chime? For socks we stowed in pairs and found alone? For mornings yet to break and the silent hot press cold? For words we'd yet to form that may have moved a stone. Thank you so much. I'm going to change tack completely. So this is a poem really about books and the single life, really, books in the bed. And the title refers to Roger's Thesaurus. I'm a big fan of all kinds of reference books. I suppose this poem, in a way, dates itself because it goes back to when you actually took down a dictionary or a thesaurus. You actually had the thing in your hand. I still like it sometimes, but I do find I use old dictionary.com nowadays. But anyway, the title refers to Roger's Thesaurus. It's called A Good Regime. I keep to myself on one side of a bed. Its other half is occupied by books, meant to match my mood, catch the thread of all my thoughts, from hard-angled works of reference to magazines, loose-leaf pads. A collection of lovelorn verse hugs an impenetrable masterpiece, while Judith Hearn's eclipsed by glamour ads. When I bring a new one back over dinner with a glass of wine, I imagine removing its paper bag, running my finger down its spine. How I fan the pages to inhale its pristine smell, then make it my own, easing back the sleeve and going down on the biographical detail. Sometimes that's the best bit, on evenings when I'm not in form to get stuck in or to commit, not even to paper. One volume alone then seems able to interject Chambers' 20th century dictionary, something new with every read and no long-term effects. I can fall asleep over a phrase whose meaning remains a stranger and wake in the morning with Roger's Thesaurus poking me urgently in the back. Thank you. Again, in my bedroom. This one is My Life as a Wardrobe. Is that right? Just to check that I'm on target. Yes, okay. My Life as a Wardrobe. Clothes hangers line up, each one a collar bone inside a form of who I used to be or who I'd like to be. Mistakes of seasons past trail from those I try not to take down anymore. A cashmere twin set I didn't care for, a halter top that came with strings attached, a houndstooth suit that never flattered me. Meanwhile, aspirations glitter from evening dresses I confine to plastic transparencies. Who I am depends on several mismatched hangers at one end. There never seem to be enough, with this year's losses and gains on display as separates that coordinate their stitching under strain on top of a side slit. Time going by, I recognize in shapes too wide on the shoulders, too short on the thigh, or in a jacket whose stress line on the hips is becoming a permanent wrinkle like the one between my brows, or like that semi-invisible seam between what is and what might have been. Again, I'll read this poem, which is a recent poem, and I know all the women here will know the phrase, you know, would I get away with it? You know, typically you're talking to one of your girlfriends and you're saying, well, would I get away with this jacket, with these trousers, and would I get away with, would these colours go, would I get away with it? And one of my friends said to me one day, what are we trying to get away with? Who's out there? Who's going to... So, this is the poem, Would I Get Away With It? What is this thing? Mention of knickers, a momentary scowl, inserting in film an additional vowel. Chardonnay, served slightly warm. Instant coffee, save us from harm. A slip of the tongue and a secret out, would I get away with it? What is this thing? A strapless top that's last year's craze and that over-eggs my decolletage. A song I've learned and never sung, and a glance that says I've lost the run. That flimsy dress without a slip, would it pinch or would it fit? What is this thing? Where are the statutes? Who serves the writ? What puts men beyond its bailiwick? Nix to the Stepford who logs every sin of the lax and unloved strumpet within. Mercy, sisters, mother of flip, would I ever get away without it? Thank you. I want to change tack a little again. It's a relatively new poem. Just to thank Patrick Cotter, I suppose, and Munster Literature Centre, because they published it on Southward, editor Matthew Sweeney. So it's called Wireless. And of course, the wireless I'm talking about is the kind of wireless we had in the house when I grew up, which was a long old wireless that I know most people won't even know what I'm talking about, with you know, knobs at the bottom that you turned and this line that went out. I can't even begin to explain it to people who don't know what I'm talking about, but a very old-fashioned wireless. So wireless. Turning the knob, you choose a station between buzzing and throbs, Oslo and Athlone. I keep it still, wedged on my attic floor, by a box of china from between the wars, and a plastic bag in which dusky tights are tangled with odd socks, a lover's old tie. I hang on to things. Rings encircling keys to places I used to live in. Notebooks where numbers are attached to names. People who wouldn't remember me if I rang, some of whom will only be found at home if the dead once more pick up their phones. I seem to think I might let myself in again, find myself in rooms I now only dream in, find that a biscuit tin of mixed cassettes contains a letter or a card I mislaid with a message that will make everything fit. Or maybe one of these nights at home, the FM band won't be so thronged. I'll happen on a half-familiar frequency where another life of mine is being relayed and someone waits for news of me. Thank you. We were talking earlier about how, talking with Bernadette about how Irish people have great capacity sometimes, well, Bernadette has for languages, and very little capacity for Irish, even though we spend a long time learning it at school, and certainly I spent a long time learning it at school and have absolutely no capacity to speak it at all. But I do tend to be interested in the, I suppose, the remnants of Irish that we use, and the effects on how we speak English in Ireland, and I have a few poems on that subject, including this recent one called The Odd Word. Because it brings to mind a thousand tedious hours of drab constraint, as adults we demur. Yet we'll choose an odd word to shape a phrase, as a skew is used to taper a surface on a lathe. Ah, that's the thing on which he hasn't any mass, we'll say, of harebells patterning a patch of grass or of a shelter belt of thorn, meaning he is one who fails to value what he's always known. Because we can still yearn when long past belief, even if we never had faith, a ghost word may weave its way inside small talk. I have an old grow for him, I may say, meaning that I harbour a regard undimmed, something on which I should keep more smocked, meaning that I do well to stick to facts, turning the deaf ear, stifling the occasional start at any sound of skittering from a ripped up heart. Okay, I'm coming close to the end now. I thought I'd just do two more poems, if that's okay. The next one is, I suppose it's about the way that corporations seem to want to be our friends in current late modernity, as the sociologists would say. I think I started writing this in, one time I was away with the choir that I sing with, and we were all away for the weekend, and I write in my hotel room, and there was a little note, a handwritten note, on my pillow, I thought, gosh, one of my choir members is sending me a note. This is interesting. And I picked it up. And it was actually the manager of the hotel with a handwritten note saying, welcome to our hotel. I hope you have a good time. I thought, how bizarre. You know, there's something wrong when corporations want to be your friend and then friendship is so attenuated and takes on such a different meaning on social media. Anyway, there's something very strange about that. And I suppose specifically, one of the annoyances I feel at the moment about ads, which try to flatter us by telling us we're smart or brave or something, they kind of annoy me. And so I was thinking of other adjectives that don't describe me too. Customer complaint. Skeptical scans an email from an online store. They love their clients. Won't she do likewise and ask her friends to like them too? She's sure they'll recover when she unsubscribes. While she likes to cheat in retail questionnaires, claims to earn a million, lies about her age. How could they improve? If the choice was there, she'd tick the box for pay your staff a living wage. Bemused receives a greeting from an erstwhile friend, suspects it's sent by virus from his contact list. With those she barely knows, she's tight. They send hourly updates to commend happenings to be well wished. Loveless leaps to grasp the heart-shaped postcard that lands in February on her mat. A quick peruse and she's aghast, caught in the front door glass. Absurd, it's a promo for TV styled limitless and just for you. Brave prepares for news she never thought to hear, bites her lip, stows the tin on its shelf. Swipes her screen and types where to share that you're no longer sure you even like yourself. Smart detects how everything she does is tracked by one remorseless, all-seeing eye. Everyone she knows and why, with little grasp of what she needs and cannot buy. This is the last poem that I plan to read, and I think the Trump poem is a little oddity, and this is a little oddity as well. And in a way, you're indulging me by letting me read it, because in some ways it's about punctuation. It's actually about the apostrophe, and it comes from one night over dinner when somebody threw down a challenge to me to write a poem about the apostrophe, because I'm a total punctuation pedant. And you know, there's lots of us around, I always find there's lots of people who are very pedantic about punctuation. But anyway, the joke of the poem is, in a way, is how it's punctuated, so that's why it's a bit of an indulgence to let me read it, because I don't know how well it'll come across. It's a new poem. It's called The Peevish Pedant, who decries mistakes and abuses. Is it overused, yet doomed to atrophy, that baffling mark, the apostrophe? For few, alas, can now do the biz and tell its meaning from its meaning it is. While many are wanton and fling it at will into simple plurals, though that's very hell. Singular pique can greet writers' misplacement and issues of ownership end in abasement. For even geniuses' pens are known to transgress in writing of things that may be possessed of a Truss or an Amos or of Lewis C.S. and of any Joe Bloggs' name ending in S. Most accede to its fate, though amongst its adherents some call for the rack for its slightest misfeasance. For my part, I swear it will still have its uses, why we pedants exist to decry its abuses. Thank you.